There's always the great question of what are you trying to do with regards to understanding the Jewishness of Yeshua? You know, why do you want to study the Jewishness of Yeshua? And I think all of you are aware that when I lived in Southern California many years ago now, in the mid to late 80s, I started in 86 or 87 sometime, studying, you know, Yeshua's being a Jewish rabbi. And that was because I read a book called Will the Real Jesus Please Stand? I don't know if that book is even available now. I saw it some time ago to where you could buy it. It is available. The last time I looked at it, it was for like $90 or something. And if I, you know, if I didn't have it in my library, which I do now, you know, for me, that $90 is a lot of money. But there's a lot of information in that book that is absolutely vital to understanding many things. And one of the features and one of the things that you should know is that, you know, the author of that book was Wendell Jones. And the author of the book being Wendell Jones, he was a personal friend of His Eminence Rabbi Yosef. And that being said, you know, for me it was always, you know, what is my motive behind studying, quote, the Jewishness of Jesus or Yeshua being a Jewish rabbi. And so when I wrote in the middle 90s, I wrote a little booklet, and it's called The Jewishness of Jesus, etc. And I've got, you know, a copy around here somewhere. But when I started the thing, when I started the classes teaching on it and all of those things, there was a lot of people who were perplexed about, you know, why would I or why would they want to study the Jewishness of Jesus or Yeshua, etc. And so I went to Philippians. And so if you go to Philippians chapter 3, I'm going to read this, and I'm going to read it from the Amplified Bible. Now, for those that don't know, you can actually find the Amplified Bible online, etc. And it's a very good translation in the respects that it tries to give you clarity on what the verses are really being said. But this is Philippians chapter 3, verse 10 and 11. And it says, "For my determined purpose is that I may know Him, that I may progressively become more dearly and intimately acquainted with Him, and acquainted with Him, and perceiving and recognizing, understanding the wonders of His person more strongly and more clearly, and that I may in the same way come to know the power outflowing of His resurrection, which it exerts over those that follow Him, and that I may share the suffering of His continual transformation in the Spirit into His likeness, even to His death, and in the hope that I, that if possible, I might attain the spiritual and moral resurrection that lifts me out from among the dead, even while I am in the body." That has always been my fundamental saying with regards to why I wanted to study Yeshua as being a Jewish rabbi. Because the bottom line, of course, is that I wanted to know Him better than I had ever known Him in my life. And of course, I found that as I studied this book, Will the Real Jesus Please Stand, that I was finding out things about Yeshua that I never thought possible to know about Yeshua. And most specifically, understanding, you know, his spiritual identity as a Jew. Secondly, his identity as a rabbi. And thirdly, you know, his identity as a Jew. And so when I stopped to think about those things, for me, the fundamental idea always is to get to know Yeshua better. Now, when I talk about the scriptures of the Nazarene Codicil and studying and reading the Nazarene Codicil, it has always been my desire to know Messiah in the most in-depth way I could possibly know and understand. Now, I came from a charismatic Pentecostal background when I was a young man, and I started speaking probably around the middle 70s, well, I guess it was 77, but I had been doing some teaching before that. I actually started teaching somewhere around 14, 15 years old, but never really, really pushed it until I started to get a little bit older. And when I finally reached the place of starting to speak about God, you know, then for me, the hunger to know God, the hunger to know all of the things about Yeshua, it increased exponentially. So that being said, my study of the Nazarene Codicil has always been a study to try to understand Messiah better. But some time ago, someone in our group, not here this evening, but, you know, in the group that has fundamentally circled around the congregation for some years, they wanted to know, and this is long before I met His Eminence and all of that, and knowing that he was really working on the triennial schedule, although that was my primary belief, that the Nazarene Codicil should be read with that. And there are other places where people have tried to deal with it, but nobody had ever come up with anything close to what His Eminence Rabbi Yosef had accomplished. That being said, the person asked me, you know, well, which parts of the Nazarene Codicil should be read with the Torah readings at which time? And my reply was, don't read the Nazarene Codicil. Stop it. And I said, what you need to do first is study the Torah. So you know, my idea for them was to study the Torah, maybe, you know, one cycle, 3.5 years or whatever, or 1 year, you know, for those that were doing an annual cycle, and to study the Torah. And then after you have mastered some of the fundamentals of the Torah, then come back and open up the Nazarene Codicil, and then start studying the Nazarene Codicil, but let the Torah be the rule by which it is interpreted by. Okay, so when it says something about the law, the Nazarene Codicil, when it says something about the law, we know it's, you know, there are five different ways, or there's even more than that, but basically five different ways it's used in the Nazarene Codicil. But we know there'll be some relationship to the Torah in that process. And so one of the other things I said and still say is that when we read the Nazarene Codicil, if we do not understand what the Nazarene Codicil is saying, believing that the Torah is, in fact, the Word of God, okay? So in other words, if you're going to tell me you believe that the Torah is the word of God, then you can't believe that it has been nullified. Okay? And of course, that all comes from the whole business of, you know, quote, the Old Testament, etc. That being said, I told them to start studying the Torah and reading the Torah. I believe it was Gerrit Gebora recently who told me that, you know, that was, you know, some very good advice because fundamentally she had done the same thing. And so I always want people to know that, you know, if we're going to read the Nazarene Codicil, we can never believe that anything in the Nazarene Codicil negates one verse or one word out of the Torah. So, once we've mastered, it is impossible to master the Torah, so please don't think that I should say anything like that. But once we've mastered some knowledge of the Torah, then one of the things that, for example, young Jewish boys, what they do is they start reading the Mishnah. Then they begin reading the Talmud, and then they read the Midrash, and then when they're somewhere approximately around 30 years of age, give or take, something like that, then they will begin to study and read Sa'odic material, specifically the Zohar, etc. But did the written form of the Zohar did not exist until about the year 1500, more or less. I'm just saying that. But for those of us who know the Nazarene Codicil and we know it well, to study the book of Yochanan, John, and to study the letters of John, and to study the Revelation, you know, we know without any measure of a question that the material is deeply Sa'odic, okay? And so being deeply Sa'odic, we understand that idea of spirituality has always been there to the Jewish people, and they always understood things on those four different levels that we generally speak of being the Hebrew word pardes, okay? That being said, last week I told you that what we wanted to do is we wanted to begin to study the idea of spirituality. And so first, now that you've heard me talk about Philippians, and you know, if you can find online, I think Bible Hub, you can go to Bible Hub, and they have the Amplified, and you can read those verses for Philippians 3:10-11. And just look at those and just try to absorb that material. But that said, I want to go to 1 Corinthians chapter 12. And I want to try to, firstly, clear up some conceptions of things that are said in the text and clarify some things so that you can find some greater meaning in the words that are here. Now I'm going to start reading out of the New King James, and I'm going to just start reading through, and then I'm going to give you a little data as we go. So 12:1, it said, now concerning, and this word in Greek is a word called pneumatikos. And P-N-E-U-M-A-T-I-K-O-S. Pneumatikos. Pneuma being the Greek word for spirit, as most of you probably already know, okay? That being said, it says here something that, you know, most people who read the Nazarene Codicil have little or no understanding of the fact that they don't even know what pneumatic coats is, much less anything else, I guess I should say. Okay, so if you're looking at your Bible, hopefully you're looking at a printed Bible. And if you're doing one off of the screen, that's fine. And if you're looking, I said I'm using the New King James. One of the reasons why I like the New King James is because it's just a shift away from all of the Elizabethan English, as it were, and we don't have all the thee, thou, and all of that with it, okay? But it said, now concerning pneumaticos, and we could just literally translate that as spirituals, okay? Now, looking at your Bible, look at the word gifts. What do you see with the word gifts? What kind of a vision do you see with that?
It's italicized.
Okay, and what does it mean if it's italicized?
It's not in the original script.
It's so, very good. So the word gifts is not there. Okay, so first thing you say is that what I'm going to do is read it spirituals and then cross out the word, mark it through, or whatever you understand to do with that word. So many times I was asked, you know, as I was teaching in a local church here, you know, what does it say? What does it say? Because it doesn't have that word, or that word's in italics. I said, take that word out and then reread it. Okay? And so here, when we take this out, this word spiritual, it should literally be put in the plural, spirituals. Okay? Now, I'm not going to try to elaborate on all of these, quote, gifts. But what I want you to understand is that they are not gifts. And let's put it this way. They're not independent one from the other so much as they are a collective set of tools and skills that we receive as we turn to Messiah. I say those things because it's very, very difficult to try to make a solid interpretation of many of those things, okay? And so let's read verse 2. And of course he says here, first one, he said, brethren, I don't want you to be ignorant. And then verse 2, you know that you were Gentiles and you were carried away with dumb idols. Okay, so one of the things that says to me is that the reason that the Gentiles had no understanding of, quote, these spirituals is because they were not Jewish. Okay? So, then that says to me, and you tell me if it's right or wrong or the way that you think or not, but if it's saying that the Gentiles did not understand it, and then he doesn't want them to be ignorant. He is a Jewish rabbi. And he is going to speak to the Gentiles who followed after dumb idols. And he's going to teach them about the spirituals. Okay, so the essence and the quality of the spiritual person that they are. And those things that are associated with the spirituals. Okay. If you read down, you will find it starts out with a word of wisdom, a word of knowledge, etc., etc. So just to use those in fundamental terms, all of these particular things that are being discussed relate to the seven men of the congregation, and actually more so to all 10 men of the congregation. But what you see from 1 Corinthians 12 is that it is a Jewish rabbi speaking to those who are Gentiles, and in my opinion, these are Gentile converts. Now, some people don't believe that, and there's room for argument for the whole piece, but nevertheless, I'm going to say that these people, if they were not converting to Judaism, they want to be close to the Jewish people, and that means that they are required to follow certain rules, and they must follow those rules before they can interact with the Jewish people. And in Ephesians, I believe it's 2:12, it talks about Gentiles having been formerly outside of the covenants of promise and outside the laws of Jewish administration. It won't read it administration in most versions, but what it basically is saying that they were not under this or subject to Jewish authority. Okay? Now, that being said, you can see the dilemma in the first two verses. So if you're a Gentile and someone starts talking to you about Chochmah, what do you say? Well, your only experience as a Gentile with Chochmah is going to be with the Greek word Sophia. And unfortunately, the difficulties or hurdles that you have to try to overcome is that you have to get it out of a Grecian mindset and then put it into a Hebraic mindset, then reread it, reinterpret it, and then try to process it through your Gentile understanding. Which is very, very difficult. And I think most of us here can basically acknowledge that, you know, to try to understand the things that we were taught while we were in the church or in Christianity or whatever, and now to understand them from a Hebrew perspective, in many times, in many cases, it's quite a challenging and daunting subject, okay? So, first thing you need to know is that he's talking about spirituals. And I will just say this without backing up my claims, so to speak. But as you go on, and we'll go on through just a couple more verses here in a minute. But as you go through, you're going to find out that what Hakam Shaul is talking about is your neshama. And when I talk about your neshama, I am saying your soul. And in many ways, Christians do not have an awareness of their neshama. They do not have an awareness of the depth of the neshama. Okay? So, for example, they only know two words. They know the word nefesh. They don't even know the word nefesh. They know it as suke, and then they know the word for the spirit, and that is pneuma. So they know suke, and they know pneuma. Those two words are the two words for soul and spirit, okay? But in Judaism, there are not just two words. There are five words, okay? And the five words are nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, Chaya, and Yechida. Okay, and I think most of you are familiar with those words and understand the fundamentals of their titles. Okay, but just now, the other thing is you can write all five of those words, and then off to the side of that where you got these words listed, you need to put the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer HaTov, okay? So the evil inclination and the positive inclination, okay? Most of the people I've known who try to talk on the line of a subject that is called soul and spirit are people who talk about the nefesh, or the, suke, and the the pneuma. And they do not understand nor know anything about the Yetzer Hara or the Yetzer HaTov. When most of the time their distinction is talking about those two particular things and not even addressing the spiritual being inside of yourself or outside of yourself, however it works on us, okay? So, everybody clear so far? Everybody understand what's being said? Okay, so when we move forward, we understand that the neshama actually is the point just above the ruach as far as the person that we are, the composite, me being a nefesh, a ruach, a neshama, a chaya, and a yechida. Those particular things that I am spiritually speaking all qualify me and prepare me to, number one, have an interaction with God, okay? And number two, you understand that within you and I, there is a divine fragment. And I don't, you know, if you can just imagine for a minute, you know, a broken glass or jar or whatever it is, in the thousands of small, finite little pieces that seem to scatter, you know, as the glass or the jar breaks, and it seems like nearly an infinity of fragments that are broken into whatever. Now, God didn't, there are ideas about broken vessels in the spiritual understandings of the text, but in the sense, God does not specifically break himself, but he some way takes a fragment of himself and then he deposits that within each one of us. So each one of us have a fragment Well, I see how this is working out.
Welcome back.
Yeah, welcome back. Okay, so continuing, each one of us has a fragment. So if you could just, for example, say, you know, put a dot on a piece of paper and then say that that dot that is on that paper is a dot that contains the divine essence, that dot would become so powerful, it would be beyond our comprehension. And then if we say that within inside of us, in some particular way, that dot was inside of us. And this is the idea that we get from Chacham Shaul, as he talks about us being the temple of the divine presence. But each one of us has this minuscule dot of the divine presence within us. And this dot inside of us also equips us and gives us every spiritual potential that you can possibly think. So, if we talk about the 10 men of the congregation, and we started out Malchut, which is the kingdom, the bottom, and then we went all the way to the top, and the top being Chochmah, those are just possibilities, okay? Just because you function on a level as a teacher in Malchut does not mean that there is not a potential of becoming a hacham or a wise man, a sage, a scholar. Each one of us possesses each one of the potentials of becoming one of the, quote, spirituals. So within inside of yourself, you have to understand or associated with you in whatever way or however it works out with God, associated to you is the potential for being a hacham. Okay? His eminence likes to drive this home like driving nails in a coffin. because he thinks and believes, and I agree wholeheartedly, that everyone should become a Chacham. Everyone should become a Torah scholar. Everyone should become a sage, etc. And you say that to some people, and when they hear you say those things, they haven't got the first clue about the fact that they can possibly become a Torah scholar. Or, they may say, well, I'm not, capable of that. Or they may use whatever negativity they want because they don't want to go there, because everyone who knows anything about it knows it requires, massive amounts of your life. And the difficulty with some circumstances is that, the husband wants to study and become a Torah scholar, but the wife does not. And so the wife does not want to become a Torah scholar, and so then there's a division in the house. Or you can turn it around. Sometimes the wife wants to be the Torah scholar, and the husband does not. And that's not a negativity toward anybody one way or the other. The only thing is that when it comes down to who wants to be and who will be and who won't be, there always has to be peace in the house. We call it shalom bayit, okay? The husband and wife, if the woman is working on Torah studies, then the husband has to accept it. I'm saying he has to accept it by meaning that he should accept it, because that's just the way it may work in that house. And then sometimes the wife might be more of a scholar than the husband, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I know a lot of old-timey preachers. I even know that some of the Torah scholars and the rabbis, they don't want women teachers, etc. Guess what? There's a saying in some groups that, Balaam's donkey was a female. Okay, so if he can use a female donkey, then surely the idea is that he could use a woman. Okay, but I have no problems with people who are women. When I was a young man, I used to not like to hear the pastor teach. I used to like to hear his wife teach. And so, you're a boy, you belong in this particular class, etc. And so I made up an excuse that, we had to record the sessions of the pastor's wife, and I was the recording engineer, so I got to listen to her teachings, okay? So that said, I think His Eminence is spot on when he thinks and believes that it doesn't matter if you're male, female, or otherwise, every one of us should do our part at trying to become a Torah scholar. That said, this idea of this pneumatikos in Greek means exactly that. Resident within you is a divine spark that will allow you to develop yourself literally beyond the potential of what you can imagine right now. So you imagine what you could possibly be. And then you write that down, and you write out a little thing, say, this is what I think I could be. And then in 5 to 10 years from now, you take and you open that up, and you read what you wrote down, and you will think, man, that was so myopic, so narrow-minded. And for me, sometimes I sit, with working on many of the things that I work, and I'm going like, man, how in the world did I get this far? Because it seems like, from the time that I was a young boy and first started reading the Bible, and then I look at myself now, and sometimes I read some of the things I wrote, and I go, who wrote that? Because the depth of the Spirit and the association with the Spirit is phenomenal. And I don't think that any group
Yep.
Well, I'm going to try to struggle for through this for another 20 minutes or so, and then before we get back next week, we'll solve this problem. Okay, so in certain groups, obviously, you know, the things differ one way from another, but here's the thing. The word spirituals, the first word in this verse, means literally that in your possession, you have everything you need to become everything that you can possibly imagine. Okay, so, again, as His Eminence has said, that the idea is that you could become a Torah scholar, etc. There's no reason why you can't. And somebody will tell me, oh, you're, you know, 35 or whatever it is that you might be, whatever age limit you think that that's the cap on trying to learn. And guess what? The day we stop learning on this place, we get to graduate and go to the academy upstairs. And so if you thought it was bad here, just wait till you die. Because then it gets worse. Because they're going to be talking there, first of all, strictly in Hebrew. And secondly, you know, I hope to be able to sit in the back of the class, man. And if not, maybe I can stand out in the hall or something and hear something and gain a little bit of wisdom from that, okay? So let's go on down just a little bit. We're going to read in verse 3. And it says that it calls, no one, Yeshua is the master, and no one can call him master except by the Ruach HaKodesh and or the Ruach Elohim. And here, you know, there's some room for argument as to which one that you would rather use. If it uses in Greek the word Agios, then it means the Holy Spirit. But at the same time, the reference, by and large, is a categorical reference to the divine presence and or the Ruach Elohim, which is the Spirit of God. And then that would take us all the way back to Genesis 1 and 2. Everybody with me? Okay, so if it's saying here that nobody can say that Yeshua is Messiah unless he has the Ruach Elohim, in essence, it's literally saying that no one can say it unless they have the Spirit of Messiah. Okay, and then you can read Romans chapter 8 and it will clarify that, but maybe sometime in the future we'll deal with that. But we can see it as a connection to that, okay? So in verse 4, he said there are diversities of gifts. Now, what has changed between this verse and the verse up above?
It's not italicized.
It's not italicized. So what is he saying? Okay, he uses two words here. Number one is pneuma, P-N-E-U-M-A, pneuma, like pneumatic tools, etc. And then he uses the word charismata, C-H-A-R-I-S-M-A-T-A, charismata. Now, many people think that the word charismata means a gift. And in some sense, what they're trying to say and what they generally try to say and what the lexicon tries to say is that, you know, they got this free gift. It's a free gift. It's called grace. It's not grace. But it is what we call, if you read it out in Greek, it says that it is the economy of chesed. I crossed the border with language there. So it means the management of chesed. So the diversities of gifts here is not pneuma, but it's charismata. So it literally puts in your hand not a tool of possibility, but a tool of necessity. And it puts upon you a tool of obligation because it is the economy of God's chesed. meaning that you are the administrator of Chesed. And it is your job to spread the Chesed. So, each one of you know people who have needs and you have something that you can give to them. Now, contrary to what a lot of the, quote, prophetic and the prosperity teachers have said in Christianity, God doesn't want you to go around giving everything you have. Yes, there is a story about a widow woman with a single mite, and that was where she lived at, but not everybody lives and functions on that level. She gave what she had, but she was more of a self-sufficient woman, if you understand the idea. And so she could give away money because she didn't need money. And, you know, she could survive without money. Money is not always the means to always having the things that you need in your life. You know, you can open up your door. Someone ring your doorbell. You open up your door. You walk to your door. And there's three or four bags of groceries there. Okay, that's the economy of Chesed, or the administration of Chesed. So you give what you have, and you have to still make sure there are things in your pantry. So here the idea is that there is a economy of Chesed. Now, what I want you to know and understand are these fundamental things. Number one, spiritual we'll make it through this lesson, and I tell everyone what you need to do is uninstall VC, take it off your computer. And then once it's installed and taken off of the computer, go to the link that His Eminence Rabbi Hillel has sent and then reinstall it, and it should update the version. We'll make it. We have a couple more minutes and we'll conclude here so that we can accomplish this before you guys get to Sunday. So, look at, okay, spiritual. What does spiritual mean? Spiritual and the spirituals are tools to get closer to God. Okay, so now you're without an excuse. God's given you everything you need to get close to Him. So He gave you all of these things, and which each thing you use, each tool you use, each thing that you try to accomplish spiritually or otherwise, these are tools, and they draw you closer to God. And let me tell you something right now. You cannot imagine the infinity of what we're talking about on this particular plane, because it has more potential than you can possibly understand. Now, Adon Tzuriel and Gibra Gibor have a set of books, and it's not the set of books. You guys just have the Encyclopedia Judaica, right? But you also have a set of the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, correct? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, but I don't really understand how to use it. I've got to have a lesson.
Okay, in that book, let me do this. Hopefully I won't knock myself off. In that book, on volume 6, page 332,
I don't think I have six volumes. I have a book that I got from Promised Land down there in Paris, but I don't think it's a theological, I don't think it had that many books in it.
Then maybe, I thought he gave you the Greek dictionary with six, it should have.
We have a Greek
dictionary.
Well, but theological work, it goes with the. It's Brown Driver Briggs we have.
Okay.
I don't know how to use that either.
That's in Hebrew. Okay. I thought His Eminence sent you guys a set of books. Was that the Encyclopedia Judaica?
Yes.
Okay. That's the difference. Okay. So here's where you can go. You can go to Strong's number if you understand how to use Strong's number 4152. That is the word pneumaticos. Now, it's not going to give you the information that I'm giving you because I go to the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament and several other things, okay? But the point here is that, you know, you can draw closer to God, and the energy that accomplishes that is, number one, the spirituals that exist with inside of yourself, and secondly, that divine spark. So that divine spark is like a magnet. Is that a book that you have there, Don Ivanair? Is that the Theological Dictionary? Yeah, okay, go to page, it's volume 6, page 332. Now you could start reading on page 332, but you better get ready because it's not one page. It's multiple pages. Yeah, what you're looking at right there is the Englishman's Concordance of the New Testament. That should, Gibra Gibora, that should be coded to Strong's, and it should be number 4151 and 4152 in that book. Okay. Yeah, I see it. And that's for the Hebrew. Yeah, Brown Driver Briggs. And that's a whole nother set of numbers. Okay, but understand this. Look at, there's the Spirit of God in the cosmos. Inside of you is this microscopic dot of the divine presence, and that dot tries to reconnect with the Spirit of God in the cosmos. It's that piece is like a magnet. It is forever drawing you closer to God, always drawing you closer to God. That's its whole intent. Now you can, as it says in the Nazarene Coastal, you can quench that spirit, you can douse that flame or that exuberance, but the idea is that you've been given this dot, and this dot has a purpose, and the purpose of that specific dot is to draw you closer to God. So, now I'm going to read you something that I posted on Facebook and then give you the scenario that is what happens when this dot begins to try to draw closer and closer to God. And you can do this experiment with a magnet and you can understand the ideology. Whenever you take a magnet and another magnet and you put them in proximity to one another, what's going to happen is it's interesting. It will never connect to its opposite side. It will always connect to the proper side. It can only connect to the proper side. And so what that is you cannot connect with God if you're on the opposite side. If your negativity is, in charge, what it's going to do is when you try to get close to God, it's going to push you away, okay? So the pursuit of godliness, which is the idea of this pneumaticos in the spirituals, is like a love affair with God. His spirit is ever drawing us closer to him and then disappearing. His disappearance sends us on a pursuit of his divine presence. When we have captured it for a single moment, we are invigorated and overwhelmed by the enormity of God's great power, literally the overwhelming, awesome power. It's literally the power called dunamis. Dunamis is also virtuous power. This power is to continue the pursuit as well as elevate our personal spiritual essence and an inspiring growth. It is, you can find this on my Facebook page, so you can get it from there, but it is the revelation of every session of Torah or Bible study. So when you are feeling revelation, when you're being inspired, this is the magnet of God drawing you closer through the mechanics of His Word. It is like a flash or a spark of the divine. When you get that moment, we call, or we've said in the past, we call it a revelation or a revelation knowledge. When you get that moment, some call it an aha moment. When you get that, that is intended, again, to draw you closer to God. A momentary unveiling of the divine essence. So it's like for one split second, you see the divine essence. You see God in the measure that it's possible for you to see God. And if you see too much, you won't be here to talk about it. But that's okay. You'll be with Him, so it won't be a problem. This is a flash from the spiritual realm, which makes an impression on our inner being. This reveals the path to the upward realms of God, and we've tasted of the divine substance of God's being.